Well, good evening. Welcome to River Styx at Duff's. My name is Michael Castro, and I'm the director of the Duff series, which is celebrating its 20th year. There's Jim Bogan popping up, as he did about 20 years ago, from Rolla. Tonight we have readings from the anthology Rising Waters, anthology that was reflections on the Great Flood, largely relating to the flood of 1993. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, about 10 people who are published in this anthology, which included something like 27 writers from mostly from Missouri and from other states. The editors are Walter Bargan and Bob Dyer, who will be up here shortly and saying a little bit more about the origins and putting together of this anthology. But I think you'll find it a very interesting evening. This is the fourth reading of this type that's taken place around the state of Missouri. There was one in Rolla, one in Columbia, and one in Kansas City. And each has had its own flavor, as I'm sure this one will tonight. But we're going to start the evening with a kind of a special appearance that's a little bit off the flood theme, but it still relates to the river. We've asked St. Louis storyteller Bertram Minkin, we've kind of commissioned him to do a story that celebrates River Styx's 20th anniversary as a literary organization, sponsoring this reading at Duff's, as well as the magazine River Styx since 1975. So we're going to launch it with Bert, and then we'll get into the Rising Waters. So here's Bertram Minkin.
The River Styx, in mythology, was a real place. There really was a river called the River Styx. And we think of it in mythology as part of a system of five rivers, along with the River Leth, from which we get the word lethargy, the River Coctus, and we think about the River of Phlegton and the River Ancrian. All of this was a group of five rivers. A distinguished literary journal, now entering its second decade of life, the River Styx, is located near the confluence of four different rivers: the Mississippi, Big Boat River, the Missouri, the Merrimack, Ugly Catfish River, and of course the De Pere, the River of Our Fathers. It's important to establish a sense of location in this second decade of life that we are entering, and think about the River Styx and how it comes out of this locale, St. Louis, Missouri. It's so often called the River City that I think we neglect to think of it as the city of the rivers. And we think about those who have come together because of the rivers that are here. Sometimes these have been unlikely events that have led to literature. A German immigrant from Pomerania by the name of William Prufrock came together to get into business in St. Louis. He got into the adjustable furniture business, the bed within the sofa, the Prufrock sofa bed. A gentleman by the name of Thomas Stearns Eliot also was here in St. Louis. Unlike Prufrock, he was born here. The grandson of William Greenleaf Elliot, Thomas Stearns Eliot would one day write the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock: "While the evening is spread against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table," the least he could have done was to say "a patient etherized upon a Prufrock adjustable sofa bed." If you think about those that the river has brought together, Well, think about a young writer who originally used pen names like Thomas Jefferson Snodgrass and Sergeant Fathom. And think about him years later. Of course, he was born in Florida, Missouri, then lived in Hannibal, lived in Keokuk, then came down to St. Louis, and would travel along many rivers. Of course, I'm speaking of the man Samuel Langhorne Clemens, who had become known as Mark Twain. And just think about his last visit to St. Louis. He was here in St. Louis in 1902 to pay a visit to 634 South Broadway and lay a commemorative plaque upon the six-year boyhood home of a poet, Eugene Fields. And it was while Mark Twain was away from the river, because the river brings people back, as I will speak about when I speak about the participants in this evening and the River Styx's history, he came back to this area in 1882 to write Life on the Mississippi and Huckleberry Finn. But before he came back, he got word. He got word of the death of somebody who had been the first to use the name Mark Twain as a pseudonym, and that was the riverboat pilot Isaiah Sellers. Samuel Langhorne Clemens had actually borrowed the name Mark Twain years before to parody Isaiah Sellers, who had routinely used that name to write his dispatches for the New Orleans Picayune and other journals and other newspapers that were published in different river cities. Twain was the name that Sellers had used. Samuel Langhorne Clemens borrowed it to write that parody. He wouldn't use it again until after he had heard of the death of Isaiah Sellers, and then during the same period when Samuel Langhorne Clemens was beginning to publish stories out in California like The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, and having heard about the death of Isaiah Sellers, he then decided to forevermore claim that name, Mark Twain, and to use that name knowing that, like Isaiah Sellers, wherever it appeared, it ought to be associated with what he called, quote, the petrified truth. And now, we think of a group of poets and a group of writers, and we think of how they came together in the city of St. Louis, the city at the confluence of four rivers. And we think of the year 1969. We think about that summer, the landing on the moon, and an event in a place called Chappaquiddick and a number of other things that were going on. But we also think about poets and writers coming together. We think about an address, 6010 Pershing Avenue. We think about the apartment of a man who happened to operate the books and recording section back in the days of actual wax and vinyl, a man by the name of Dan Spell. We think of fast food, and we think of things being passed around that perhaps ought not to be mentioned in public. But this was an evening for those who would come to bring their poetry. We think of an academic poetry scene at Washington University, but that wasn't the scene of that apartment on Pershing Avenue. Fast food and perhaps some fast talk. Perhaps people from a number of different backgrounds coming together. Certainly there were from a number of different backgrounds. I see in my mind a gentleman who was very fond of folk dancing traditions from around the world and had a very great love of Bob Zimmerman of Hibbling, Minnesota, a.k.a. Bob Dylan. I see him here this evening, and his name is Howard Schwartz. I see that tradition, the Judaic tradition in America, coming together with other traditions. I think of a group that bore the initialism BAG, and I think of African-American artists of all different backgrounds, Carter Rivard of a Native American background, I think of a Sephardic Jew. Yes, Michael Castro. I think of Jan Castro. I think of people coming together, Donald Finkel, many others contributing to the discussions during that time, Eugene Redmond, names that have become names that people think about when they think about writing as opposed to literature in St. Louis. All of that was part of a community that would begin. I think of a radio show. I think of listeners tuning in. I think of an early magazine, a press. I think of a very appropriately named printer, Huckleberry, Huckleberry Harris. I think of that invaluable technical assistance. I think of poets and writers with staples and Xerox sheets of paper collating parties. Wasn't that a wonderful idea? Have a party, get it all together, instead of have a party for the signing of the dust jacket. That's how it all began. And by 1975, the magazine would appear that is now in its 20th year, as it will be celebrating that anniversary in 1995. You know, you could say in the literary sense that this would be a landmark anniversary. But I think of this in terms of the River Cities, and I think of not landmarks, but sounding the depths, communication, how measurements were taken. Quarter less Twain, Mark Twain. Quarter train, half Twain. Quarter less three, Mark three. Quarter three, half three. Quarter less four, Mark four. And you see, all measurements after that were considered no bottom. That's really what you wanted to hear. It would be smooth sailing ahead. What I want to say on this great occasion is that for River Styx, I see no bottom. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Bert, for that kind of evocation of the literary history of St. Louis and including River Styx in it. We're going to now bring up one of the editors of Rising Waters, who's a wonderful singer and songwriter as well as a poet. Actually, he's one of the great folk historians of Missouri. From Boonville, Bob Dyer.
Well, hello, everybody. I sure do like this place. It's been a while since I've been here. And look at all those familiar and nice faces I see out there. And Bert. I hadn't seen Bert for 25 years, 69 probably, that magical year you mentioned. I'm going to start off. I couldn't decide whether to start with this or end with this. And I think maybe it's better that I start with it. I'm going to sing you a song I wrote, and then I'm going to read a couple of the poems that I wrote that are in the anthology. But this song I want to do first is a somewhat difficult song for me to sing, but it's an important one for me. 3 years ago, I believe it was, there were two women who were killed here in St. Louis, the Carey sisters. Julie Carey was a fine poet who was one of Howard Schwartz's students, as a matter of fact. and Howard originally wrote me about her and sent me a group of her poems that she had written, and I was just stunned by those poems, especially in light of what happened to her. And I just couldn't resist writing a song. But basically, this is not my song as much as it is her song, because most of the words in this song come directly from her poems. And I think what I want to do is read you the one poem of hers that I took most of this song from first, and then sing you the song. It's a poem called The Undertow, and that's the name of the song. How am I going to do this? This is awkward. Here we go. Here's her poem, a poem by Julie Carey. Picture yourself 1,000 tiny pebbles rushing downstream in the current that presses your skin against huge, jagged rocks, as frightening as you are frightened. Remember that the undertow can take you in so easy. Then imagine that I am the silt, thick and coarse, and not nearly as lovely as the waterfall. Think how I can bury you in my cool, muddy layers beneath all that brings you pain. Imagine how tenderly I can fold my flesh around you. I imagine, can you hear the guitar all right back there? On the bridge above the chain of rocks, she saw herself 1,000 tiny bubbles floating helplessly downstream. The current pressed her skin against the jagged rocks, the rocks that were as frightening as she was frightened then. Remember that the undertow can take you in so easy. Take your hand, lead you dancing down dark alleys to the place where dancing ends. She thought she saw it coming, prophesied it with her pen on paper napkins in a cozy night cafe. But when it finally found her on the bridge, it had a name that was more dangerous than any she could say. Remember that the undertow can take you in so easy. Take your hand and lead you dancing down dark alleys to the place where dancing ends. And so they pressed her body down beneath their jagged bodies. Still the song that they would never hear her sing. And so the river took her in and held her in its cool and muddy layers, and it took away her pain. Remember that the undertow can take you in so easy. Take your hand and lead you dancing down dark alleys to the place where dancing ends. Her hand no longer pens the words she polished like the tiny stones. The current of the rushing river rose, and though her voice is silent now, her words like leaves come back each time the story in this song of hers unfolds. Remember that the undertow can take you in so easy. Take your hands, lead you dancing down dark alleys to the place where dancing ends. Thank you. She wrote a number of very beautiful poems, and quite a few of them had a very strange kind of prophetic sense in them, given what happened to her. Well, let's see. So Walter and I, while the flood was going on, started thinking, I'll bet there's a bunch of writers out there that have this flood on their consciousness and are thinking about it and are hopefully writing about it, or if they're not writing about it, if we sent out the word and said, hey, write about it, maybe they would. So that's kind of how this whole anthology got going. And we got a lot of stuff, a lot of very interesting stuff. We didn't use all of it, and not necessarily because it was bad, some of the stuff, but just because it didn't quite fit with what we had in mind doing. But we did end up with, I think, a very interesting selection of poetry from around the state, and we've had a great time going around the state doing these readings and getting the poets from various parts of the state to know one another better. I'm going to read you I've got two short poems that I included in the anthology. And these are both related to things that actually happened there around my hometown of Boonville, where I live, there on the Missouri River. I don't know how many of you know that town, but there's an old bridge across the Missouri River there that's in the process of being replaced now. And, of course, during the flood, that bridge was closed down, and the townspeople, for it seemed like all summer long, made a kind of a regular evening event out of after work. Everybody would walk out across the bridge and go look at the flood. And one of the poems relates to an incident that happened during one of those evenings. The other one has to do with, there's a very beautiful city park in Boonville called Harley Park that has an overlook, one of the better overlooks of the Missouri River, anywhere on the Missouri River. And it's right below an Indian mound, a Middle Woodland period Indian mound. And that was another favorite gathering place for people during the flood, including a lot of the out-of-town people that came off I-70 to see the flood, and a lot of the media people who came there. The local weather people from Columbia came over and gave their weather reports standing on top of the Indian mound, which is It just seemed like such an interesting, strange conjunction of things to me, because in those Indian mounds are more than likely buried the old shamans of the Indians that used to live along the river, the people that really knew about rain and floods and weather and that sort of thing. So I thought that was kind of an interesting thing, too. So one of the poems relates to that. Now I've got to find them. Okay. The first one's the Indian Mound one. This is called Looking for the Signs. And this pretty much sums up what I feel about the flood and about my whole attitude toward the river. And it's somewhat different than the conventional one, I guess. But this is what I believe. Atop the mound where some old nameless shaman sleeps outside our history, a TV weatherman broadcasts the flood, predicting what we all know well by now, more rain. While down below, the locals line the stone wall of the scenic overlook, scanning flooded fields for something known, muttering about the need for more and bigger levees. But these fields always were the rivers, even when we willed them not to be. What makes us think we know the river better than the river? Why anger when the river floods, not awe? And why resistance when we could let rain and river go wherever rain and river need to go? The second one is the incident on the bridge, and this is called As Close to Resurrection. The two people mentioned in here are two actual people I know. They're in Boonville. One of these, the main character in this thing is an interesting guy that I still haven't gotten a copy of this book to. He's asked me about it two or three times, and we keep missing, but I'm going to get him a copy of this book for sure, because this is really his poem. Larry's out there on the long line of what used to be the levee, walking on the water like a lonesome Jesus, wishing he knew how to make a miracle come down and save his flooded house. Not likely now, with water rising past the soles of what might be his last shoes, if he doesn't break the river's spell and head back for the bridge where we are watching him. And then somehow he does, dissolving in the red sun setting at his back, his white house tilting toward the swirl and glitter of its own long shadow. Wayne has it all on video, and that's as close to resurrection as we'll get. When Wayne and Larry, Larry's house, the levee, bridge, and flood, and all of us are gone. Thank you.